Noon, I'll now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, February 1st, 2024. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum to do business. Today with us are Senator Jesse Keel, Senator Lukey Tobin, Senator Rob Myers, and myself, Chair James Kaufman. Oh, and I want to acknowledge Senator... Senator Wilson's working his way. Okay, so Senator Wilson is also here. So thank you. The eyes of the committee keeping watch. Staffing the committee today is my Transportation Committee aide, Emma Torkelson, our LIO moderator, Dylan Williams, and Lisa Denny from Records. So before we plow on, please silence your cell phones. So the introductory hearing today on a governor's executive order 131 has been postponed to a later date. So we only have one thing on our agenda, and that's a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on their winter weather operations. So our invited testifiers presenting in person today for the Department of Transportation, Ryan Anderson, Commissioner of DOT and Public Facilities, Sean Holland, Central Region Director, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant for DOT PF. Let's see, joining us online or on the phone as time goes by will be Jason Sokolaskis, Chief of Maintenance Operations, Brad Bosma, Manager of State Equipment Fleet, Ryan Marlowe, UAS Program Coordinator for Statewide Aviation, Tim Glassett, Statewide Avalanche and Artillery Program Manager. That's going to be fun to hear about. Mm-hmm. And Kirk Warren, Central Region M&O Chief. So I think I've got everyone. And because of some technical difficulties, we'll be going on the phones today rather than the video that was originally planned. So I want to thank you all for being here. So for all of the testifiers, reminder, to keep track of all the names, please restate your name each time you begin speaking so that our record secretary taking the minutes can follow along. To all, please address your comments through the chair. With that, Commissioner Anderson, you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin.
Okay, thank you, Chair Kaufman. For the record, my name is Ryan Anderson, and I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. First, just thank you, Chair and Senate Transportation Committee, for the opportunity to speak today on what I think of anybody that's in Alaska today cares very much about, and it's our winter weather and how we respond across the state to different events and just our winter weather response. So I think today what we wanted to do for a presentation was really give you that big picture. You know, this is how DOT works. This is how we're set up. This is when we go in and respond with our M&O forces, with our equipment, you know, on the facility side. But then also recognize, you know, we're going to talk about Anchorage and the storm back in November today and how that worked out and some of the things we learned from that storm and how we're moving forward. And also the avalanche program. This year has been a extremely active avalanche year. We've had multiple road closures over the past months, you know, based on the heavy snowfalls and what we're seeing out there and across the state. So really wanted to give you that sense of you know, how DOT is tackling these challenges, you know, how we're taking an agile approach and we're learning as we go, but recognizing that, you know, yeah, this is a pretty good winter for us in Alaska across the state. And you know, there's a lot of work going on and we have some fantastic people out there that are getting the job done. So with that, we'll begin.
Thanks for that. Let me just ask with your presentation, the runtime on it, would you like to take questions as we go or save them towards the end?
Yeah, Chair Kaufman, I think we're happy to take questions as we go. We kept the slides to a minimum just to make sure we could have good discussion because we recognize there's probably going to be a lot of questions.
Great. That's really what we want, so I appreciate that. I think we have our first question. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, and it's great to see you, and I will attest for the record that Commissioner Anderson's also was removing snow this morning, so he just has a hands-on experience in snow removals. But my question, I guess, is I know you mentioned the significant snowfall this early winter, but you said Anchorage, but I believe the community just north of Anchorage also had a significant snowfall as well as southeast. So hopefully we can talk about some of those items as well, because every morning, Commissioner, I would like the department to think about what can I do for the Mat-Su.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. With that, I would like to hand it over to Mr. Mills to talk a little bit about our snow summit back in October.
And for the record, Andy Mills, Special Assistant Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So I have this slide because this falls under the special and special assistant. I got an opportunity to coordinate this. It was a large team of individuals at the department. And what I hope folks start off by understanding is, even though alliteration is amazing, this was a special focus for the department, because we know the importance that winter operations are for constituencies, for policymakers. And so this, and I'll put air quotes, inaugural, because we were asked to potentially do it again. I think there is an appetite for us to reprise another snow summit in the future, was meant for stakeholders and policymakers to come together on a series of issues that we had separate conversations about, but wanted to find sort of synergistic opportunities to share both the challenges we're having, the operations we have, and some of the innovations we are actively working on. And so in this presentation, you'll see some of those. But in the Snow Summit, we have listed on the screen, I don't plan to read through all of these, but it does range from our M&O folks talking about the operations, both from a practical on the ground and also from a policy side during that Snow Summit. We did talk about prioritization of these sidewalks, because pedestrians and non-motorized users are important, and we continue to hear that as an area we need to make improvement. We did talk about 511. We did talk about some of our newer programs, such as the expansion of ice roads and snow trails. And so this was a very good summit attended by over 80 individuals in Anchorage. Again, we did stream it online for anyone who would like to go back and watch those materials. And certainly that information is there and archived for folks to hopefully carry the conversation on. I'll note on this that we did the snow summit in October to get ahead of the snows. And there are some meaningful things that came from the snow summit, not just the naming of a plow, Darth Blader, which was, of course, a fun part of the snow summit. But from that, I know anecdotally, we did have folks in the room from DOT and the municipality and localities that made connections at the Snow Summit that carried on after. And it has, I believe, others would say, materially added to the coordination and partnerships that we continue to try to work on, to clear roads, to discuss about, you know, overlap or where jurisdictions meet each other, and try and do a better job for the public, who frankly does not care about where those lines are drawn. And so I'll go ahead and stop there, and we can advance the next. So on slide 3, again, from the Snow Summit as a follow-up, as an example, we have a newer office, the Division of Modernization and Innovation, which is an effort that's been in the works, and Commissioner Anderson has really driven home that innovation using data and new tools are ways that we can both internally have better decision-making capabilities and also for the public to have greater transparency on what's happening with department activities and decisions. So in this case, the top of the slide, which if you would like, and Mr. Chairman, at your will, there's a QR code if people would like to scan it. And we're hoping at home they would be able to. That gives them this dashboard that we have at the top of slide 3. The winter maintenance priority map we do have already, but it was a very constrained GIS map that didn't provide more information than the set priorities. And so the task here is to, again, expand on, there was legislative intent that talked about road priorities. We came back and talked about those last legislative session. And this map is intended to expand upon that information. In particular here, what you'll notice is that lane miles have been added so that as infrastructure or changes happen, we have the ability to sort of show and track that information relative to our maintenance priorities. The reason that can be important is as you add infrastructure, that resourcing gets spread out and or needs to be reevaluated given the different criteria we did describe in last year. And so I won't cover that again, but this is intended to be a tool that makes future innovation in road, how we display road priorities, more transparent to the public, and also show some of the factors that are behind some of those road priorities. And I expect this to grow in time. I'll pause as I see there's a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this. The interactive map has been very helpful. I've shared it with a few constituents. And I'm curious, as one of the questions is, I'm not sure what white means, the white roads. I'm looking at the map in Anchorage and diving in, and much of the area that I represent have white, and I don't know what the white is.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I believe the white roads, as with the current map and this map that we are looking to improve, are roads that are not DOT roads. So the road priorities represent, through the color spectrum, the different priorities that DOT assigns to its roads. And so if it does not have a designated color on it, typically it means it's a different jurisdiction that is covering road maintenance on that. And so on the bottom of this slide three, you will see a different innovation that our folks are working on, this new Modernization and Innovation Office, the Winter Operations Dashboard, which we did talk about at the Snow Summit. What the Winter Operations Dashboard is intended to do is make good on the conversations. We used the terminology track a plow before. And again, I've been told that's a little too big brothery, so we're trying to look at other ways to show the information. And there are some very good questions about how real time some of this information should be versus making sure that we're simply letting folks, the public, know where those maintenance activities have just occurred. So you could, in theory, and that's the attempt here, that road has been cleared an hour ago. That means this should be a good route to take. What's really exciting about this, and I want to call out Christine Langley, appreciation for all her efforts leading that new division. In particular, the Winter Operations Dashboard will look to bring in other data that is not just DOT data. Because it's an ESRI platform, we are looking at other jurisdictions. I know that the municipality or the Mat-Su Borough, MOA, there's a lot of municipalities and boroughs who use that same platform and therefore have similar systems that we can integrate data, because again, at the heart of it, the public doesn't, they're not worried about who is operating. They're worried about what the road looks like. So the more we can make a one-stop shop, the more beneficial I think the public would find a dashboard and not having to skirt roads with priority colors and ones that don't.
Did you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm still stuck on the interactive map, so I'm just going to dive in a little bit deeper. As I see here, using my handy-dandy smart device, that Gamble and Ingra are white. And I'm very curious, does that mean DOT does not provide winter maintenance for Gamble and Ingra, or is that in collaboration with the municipality of Anchorage? Can you help me understand a little bit more?
So through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's an excellent question, and I can point to other examples. It would almost be fun to pull up the map and show you. I know I can go further south in Anchorage and show you some examples that make you scratch your head a little. In that case, I believe that's because of the transfer of responsibility agreement or TORA that we have on those roads. And I see Director Holland doing the head shake. And what that means is you'll find roads that are DOT roads, but they are maintained by another entity, in this case, the municipality of Anchorage. And that's because of that transfer of responsibility where we're trying to find route efficiency by having them do a certain section, and we'll trade for maintenance of something else. And we are constantly looking at ways to review that list so that if there are things that don't make as much sense, we're actively looking at adjustments to that. And the road priority map will show updates over time to those changes.
So with that, does that also include the pedestrian assets that are in those areas? You and I have talked a little bit about how we prioritize sidewalks and pathways, and particularly looking at Ingle and Gambro, where most folks walk. Would that be something we'd need to work with our municipal partners on in prioritizing those sidewalks and pathways?
Again, through the chair, Senator Tobin, again, an excellent question, because the Snow Summit did highlight one of the things that Fairbanks has done over the last couple of years. They have created a separate priority system for their pedestrian and unmotorized facilities. DOT has prioritization on its roads, and that coupling with the road and the pedestrian facilities are the same. To decouple those allows pedestrians and non-motorized users to consider some facilities that may be lower from a road perspective, but higher from a pedestrian. So, as an example, certainly routes to schools, transit facilities, some of those could modify the prioritization of some of those pedestrian facilities. So the answer for you is right now they are coupled together, and we would certainly look to work with a local jurisdiction to establish separate priorities that could modify how roads and sidewalks are maintained, with a little difference.
Thank you. Thank
you. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, and I will say that, in terms of snow pileup or state roads and where the state road meets a borough road or city road and some hazards, I will say I appreciate DOTs and the borough and the city working together to eliminate some of those issues and not try to get into power struggles of who put the snow there or who the snow belongs to and just taking care of the situation. So I really appreciate you guys working with them and handling those situations. I just want to make sure clear. So let's say Senator Tobin's question in terms of city maintenance and sidewalks. So Egan Drive is the state road. So you guys would actually do the snow removal on the sidewalks and pedestrian pathways on Egan?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Wilson, that is correct. We currently will do pedestrian facilities associated with priorities roads.
Just want to make sure. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, let's proceed.
I believe I'm turning the...
I'll take it.
Very good.
Okay, yeah, Commissioner Anderson, for the record. So with that, what we would like to do now is talk a little bit about the big picture of winter operations and maintenance across the state and how really we're set up in Alaska through our maintenance districts to provide those services to Alaskans. I believe we have Mr. Jason Sakalaskis on the phone, and he's our lead. He leads the maintenance folks up out of the northern region and has been with the department over 20 years and really has a great perspective on this. And so if it's okay with the chair, I would let him speak to this slide. Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Jason. You can hear me.
Thank you, Ryan. Jason Sakalaskis, Northern Region Maintenance Operations Chief, for the record. Thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. Want to kind of talk about, some of our maintenance operation from the statewide perspective. What you see here before you is really our regional and district breakout with on the map. As you can see, some of our districts are larger than the state of Florida. Sometimes multiple times larger than Florida. So as we all know, we tackle a great expanse across Alaska in many different departments and travels. So one of the things I wanted to touch on here today is really just acknowledging the number of districts within each region and speak to kind of some of the budgeting processes we use that provide us flexibility to deliver our services. As you can see, Northern Region has districts presented here really in the blue. Central Region has five districts present in the yellow. And South Coast Region has two districts presented in the light blue. With that being said, one of the illustrations that we want to show here is that we got a vast diversity of needs within both region and district. I'd like to draw attention to kind of Northern Region with my expertise lying there. Seeing us in the Western District, if we were to focus on that district momentarily, we would see a lot of basically airports serving a lot of those facilities with potentially a lot of reduced, I'll say, responsibility in roads. That's unlike Fairbanks District, where we have a lot of roads with our responsibility there and limited airports. The reason why I draw this attention is because that's the same within other districts, within our regions, similar to Southwest District and Central Region, and Anchorage proper. So with that, our budgeting process does establish budget by region. from the regional component, we actually work within our maintenance sections to budget down to a district level. The reason why this is important to us is it provides flexibility for us to meet all needs. Our responsibility is for both highways and airports. To do so, this flexibility is needed at both the district and regional levels and allows resources to be moved within basically each district so that services can be delivered. Can we move on to slide number 5?
Excuse me, we do have
a question. I'll ask if there's any questions.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. Just to clarify, you talked about doing highways and airports together within districts and being able to move assets. Have you figured out a way to use an airport asset on a street or vice versa?
Through the chair. In some cases, we have been able to use airport assets on highways. It depends how the funding stream is invested in the original piece of equipment. Primarily, if we have assets like equipment on airports, which are state funded, we're allowed to use them both on airport and state highways needs. If they're funded through what we call an AIP program, so assigned to the airport designated piece of equipment, we have been able to use those on highways more during emergency situations, which is most likely when they're required. We've worked through the FAA to get those approvals and have established processes to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hopeful that he'd crack the nut for general efficiency, but it sounds like sometimes funding streams dictate more than one piece.
All right. Well, thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. On slide 5, we're looking at the winter operations and budgets and speaking to really snow removal priority systems. One thing we wanted to show here and demonstrate is how these systems work, both within our own operations and within sharing information with the public. As you can see before you, there's several categories, A through E. These categories link to a description and to an illustration also shown on the roadway. Internally within our operations, we use the description and illustration to show targets to our operators and our management staff on what our expectations are based upon our roadway priority levels. As we know, our priority levels are set 1 through 5, with 1 being the highest and 5 being non-maintained during the winter. For the priority 1, we can expect that service delivery after a storm, clearing our roadways, our desired target is A. I think we all agree that bare pavement, good visibility is what we desire during the winter, and that's on our priority 1 routes. When doing that, we also move down to its corresponding to move to priority 2 through 4, and meaning B and C categories. These categories drop by priority level or target, leading to the definitions and descriptions provided along with the pictures and illustrations. I'd like to note that D and E categories are not a performance target, but yet only lead to a condition of roadway. This is important to note because of how we communicate uniformly with the public. We utilize our 501 system to report conditions to the public during events. It's important to report uniformly so that way when driver expectancy travels along long distance routes, drivers know what to expect. Reporting the roadway condition in good means something both to our operators and to the public. So when reporting experiencing a good weather condition, you should see the description provided. In fair and difficult conditions, obviously these will be in adverse shape, and it's extremely important to stay consistent when we're experiencing very difficult and hazardous winter conditions. Are there any questions with regards to how we provide and how these work together both in communication with the public and our own internal staff.
There does not appear to be any questions from the committee. I'm just curious, so, and these categories, these scores, these are displayed where in the previous slide that we saw, the kind of dashboard?
Yes, I'll say correct. Our priorities will speak directly to what I'll say is A, B, and C, good, fair, and poor conditions that we're targeting within our routes.
Yeah, through the chair, Commissioner Anderson, for the record. Yeah, so there's kind of two things that are happening here. I mean, one is if you look at 511 and you look on our website with 511, you'll see these colors match to these driving descriptions. And really for our M&O staff, our maintenance and operations, this is the performance target that they use to go and report the condition of the roadway. So when we get into a winter event and we're moving, moving through the evolution of a cycle, you'll see on 511 the conditions, match what you see on this slide as we go through our different priority levels of roads. So a priority one roadway, could be a C at times, but we work to get it back to the A. Yeah, if that helps.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
Okay.
Let me move on to the next slide six, please.
Okay. Go ahead, Jason.
So slide number six shows what we're trying to illustrate here is the diversity of our airport operations across the state. The prior slides covered how we communicate on roadways and our expectations on those routes. Within Alaska, we have a diverse airport system, of which 82% of our communities rely on primary access to their communities. As you can see, there's 235 rural airports with 26 Part 139 airports. Within these areas, we have both staff airports, which are primarily our Part 139 airports and large hub airports, which have DOT staff present in delivering these services. In a lot of the satellite airports or other rural airports, we have what we would say we call RAM contractors. These are rural airport maintenance contractors that are hired within the community to perform basic maintenance and operations snow removal service and general aviation system light repairs. Some of the operations at our rural airports consist of general snow maintenance and operations during the winter months. Like I said, aviation system lighting repairs. And also most important is runway condition reporting. We displayed earlier on, we use 511 to communicate our messages on highways. Within the aviation district, for those of you familiar with flying, this is done through a NOTAM process. So each morning, our airport contractors or our airport personnel are required to inspect our runways and give an accurate condition runway report, which then we distribute through flight service in cooperation with flight service and NOTAM to aircraft. This ensures that the aircraft landing at our airports are aware of the conditions at our airports or any hazards present. As you can see, there's some cost representation on the slide as well. We find that at our rural airports, we are on an average of an annual contract amount of anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 per airport. And some of the quick facts that I've been able to assemble through coordination with other regions, I found we have basically 128 contractors across our region. And the average, with multiplying those out, were around $3 to $4 million a year in annual cost associated with running those contracts. These individuals are vitally important to servicing our rural airports and these moving goods and services around our communities. Thank you for your time and presentation. If there are any questions, I can answer them now.
Thank you. We have a question. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. And I guess this goes to more of the operation side of the budget, but my concern was that talking to a couple of operators in the department about being paid on time and sort of the work morale and keeping people on staff and seeing how payroll issues to keep people sort of clearing the path because we want to shovel the love.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson. Yeah, payroll is definitely a focus for us. We're tracking those things, these notice of pay problems. We even in the commissioner's office, I have a person designated that if someone doesn't get paid, or if someone has a problem that is a serious payroll problem, because we recognize recruitment retention, we got to have people paid. That's the core of things. But we have a person that, we've advertised across our department. We give a phone number, call them, talk to them, and then, from the commissioner's office, we go and tackle that and get it resolved as quickly as possible. So that has been one approach we've taken. We also, working with all of our divisions, making sure that we're all communicating on it. And so everyone is, we understand, when if there's a trend occurring that we're on top of it, we recognize it, and then we address it. But things, there have been improvements. We have taken steps, like on the Alaska Marine Highway System, DOT took payroll back. And so we're taking some proactive steps like that. In that instance, it's because of those contracts are just different and more complicated. And it really, it made sense that, we would take that. So we did that. So we're working this, to make sure we keep it good. But we definitely recognize, we've got to get people paid. Now, there's no doubt about that.
You have any information on that ultimately that you can provide to the committee? Appreciate it. And Senator Wilson, follow up.
Yeah, I just want to ask: did you take over payroll for the entire DOT NPF folks, or just the Marine Highway System?
Yeah, but through the chair, Senator Wilson, just for the Marine Highway System. For those specific unions, the maritime unions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Senator Tobin? Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to be a compound question. As you know, I was born and raised in Nome. Many of the folks that are very close to my father were DOT employees who did clear our airport. And so I'm curious to know if the contracts, the 128 today, how they compare to 10 years ago or how they compare to 20 years ago. Because in rural Alaska, DOT positions are coveted. But we know that I anticipate in the future slides we'll be talking about staffing and staffing shortages, and I'm just curious if there is an increase in contract positions because we have been unable to recruit and retain DOT employees in these areas. With that being said, I would love to know the average cost being $50,000 to $100,000 per airport. If those were DOT employees, what would be the average cost? What would that look like? What's the delta between those two pieces? Would it be more expensive to have an employee in those areas, or would it be less expensive to the state?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin. To address your first question, it definitely on the workforce side of things, we're seeing the stress all around, whether it's in-house staff or contractors. I think if we looked at our contracting and our bidding, there's some areas where it's getting tougher to find contractors. And one of the things, we've been doing is trying more programs, to stimulate folks, get that interest going in these types of jobs, working on roads, working on airports, and behind the scenes, let's get that workforce back in the mix here so we can have people out there that can bid on these jobs or, we can hire. So we can certainly give you some numbers from 10 years to comparative to now. And that's a fair question, and so we'll follow up on that. And then when it comes to the thought of the contracting versus the in-house staff and how the costs are, that's a tough question to answer right now. I think this is something that's been tried and true for 10, 20 years plus on how we've been contracting. So to try to compare it, but we could certainly provide you that cost of what an employee costs, and then the different costs of equipment and fuel and all these kind of things too as well. So we can break that out.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. No other questions. Let's proceed.
Okay. For the record, Ryan Anderson, this is a slide that, you know, is one we pay very much attention to these days, and this is our vacancy rates, winter operations, our equipment operator positions, and this is from a report that we received on January 29th. This is basically what it shows you is the number of equipment operator positions by those maintenance districts that we showed on the map, and then it shows you a vacancy rate, and so when it says 19% vacancy rate for Anchorage District, that's 19% of those 48 positions aren't filled. We watch these carefully. You know, as you can see, they vary as you go across the districts. There's even more variance when you look at a camp by camp level, meaning we have some camps where there may be two people, and so if one leaves, you're down to 50%. So there's you know, that in the background. I think what we take away from this, you know, I think in my experience pre-pandemic, we would see 8 to 12%. That was pretty typical for us as DOT. And now you see the numbers of where we're at. Some interesting things that of note, just we had a report from OMB just over from July 15th, 2023 to December 15th, 2023, that 6-month period. 378 positions were vacated at DOT. During that time period, 225 of those employees left state service, and that's about 60% of those numbers. The other 40%, they just moved on to other state employment. Of the folks that left state service, there was 225. 103 were equipment operators, and those equipment operators have an average time with the state of 2.5 years. The kind of the average we've been hearing is 3.5 years. And so we're looking at that in terms of, you know, it looks like our equipment operators at DOT are not sticking around, you know, as others are. So we're paying attention to these kind of statistics and asking a lot of questions to see what's possible. Now, on counter to that, from the 378 positions that were vacated, we also hired 358 over that same time period. And of those 358, 22 came to DOT from other departments within state service, but 152, they didn't have any indicator of prior state service. They came from elsewhere. And then the remainder were internal promotions and things that happened. So, you know, paying attention, there's a lot of movement going on in the ranks, and that's for sure. And I think that's something we've been seeing for some time.
Thank you. Some pretty amazing numbers when, you know, in aggregate, average of 22.3%, but some of the high ones are 33%. I think that's the, I guess one thing I'm wondering from a utilization perspective, I don't know, maybe it's coming up later, but if you had the people, would you have the equipment? Is the equipment readiness there? Do you essentially have equipment that's would be ready to roll if we only have people?
Yeah, Chair Kaufman. Yeah, I think what you see here is it is what would change. You know, there's a lot of times when we get into events or other situations, overtime usage, and you know people are working a lot, and so having that ability to, you know, give people a little more on the normal schedules, so the equipment usage would be tied to that, and so we're getting the job done, I think, you know, people are going above and beyond a lot out there, you know, to make this work.
Thank you. Any
questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the hope is we retain the folks that are there now. Do you have retention strategies, or what are you thinking about how we keep folks on the job today?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin. Yeah, what a great question. That's something we've taken a few different approaches to, but also recognizing that, you know, there's union negotiations going on right now regarding wages and benefits and those things. So I won't comment too much on, I won't comment on those. That would be a labor relations piece. But things that we've done to keep people, I think, you know, looking at people's schedules, we recognize that there's been some, and it's different in different areas. You know, when we looked at places where we had remote camps, like on the Dalton Highway, we went to a two-on, two-off schedule, and we saw some success there and people that was appealing to staff. We also went through an exercise on the West Coast with mission critical incentive pay, because we were getting to a point where at those airports, we were down to a number of people that if we lost too many more, we were not going to be able to keep the airport open. And so just to keep those people there, you know, instituting the mission critical incentive pay, and then now recruiting to see what we can attract. But it is hard to find. Those are, you know, the airport rescue firefighting certified individuals. There's an expertise there, and it's challenging to find those people. But that was another approach we took. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the other side of that, the recruitment piece, are you guys doing your own hiring and recruitment? Is that back in your house, or is that still in the Department of Administration?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson. Yeah, we do that now. And so we have a group that's just focused on recruitment and all the processing of the hiring paperwork and everything. So that's within our control and managing. And then we have also on the recruitment side, we've actually taken our communications team and given them an additional focus of, hey, how can we reach out? How can we use social media? How can we, you know, strategize to get the word out on these jobs and even change the tone and the language of our recruitment notices? One thing that we see attracts people, Alaska, if you sell it right, it's kind of, you know, it's a pretty neat thing to look at it. Well, wherever you're at is these kind of jobs. And so that's we're trying to push on that, is how do we show that to people so they see it and that gets them excited.
Quick follow-up?
Yeah, we were talking with another department last week, or I think it was last week, Department of Family and Community Services, and they've gotten down their hiring from, used to be 30 days from basically interview to offer day, to about 10 days. Mm-hmm. I knew a diesel mechanic who went to apply for DOT, and it took 45 days for them to interview to offer letter. Situation, and I just wondering, if are you guys monitoring that situation, or how? I mean, just wondering that front end.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson. Yeah, we do track those things. I don't have those numbers, but we could provide them for you all, so you can see what our overall numbers are on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Let's proceed.
Okay, and with this slide. I was going to pass it off to Brad Bousma. He's our statewide equipment fleet manager, just to speak to our overall management of our resources of equipment and those things. So, Brad, if you're on, if you could go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, my name is Brad Bousma. I am the equipment fleet manager for the state of Alaska. Our division is called State Equipment Fleet, or SEF. Acronyms are a favorite DOT thing. So, SEF is responsible for about 7,700 fleet assets, plus about 800 assets that are owned by the University of Alaska, Alaska Housing, and other state agencies. But about 7,700 of them that we maintain across the state, and they are spread out in every location. Across the state. Maintenance, the map you're seeing on this slide here is a map of the manned stations where the fleet has a mechanic. There is actually a few missing there. I've seen Nome and Kotzebue. Looks like we got a little overlap in the slide there, but we do have some in Western Alaska as well. But from those 51 manned locations, we maintain equipment at every DOT maintenance station and every DOT owned airport, and the 235 rural airports that you saw on the slide before. There's 123 mechanic positions that we have. And then also another division for backup division for DOT is the PF and DOTPF, which is the Division of Public Facilities and Facility Services, which maintains about 800 different facilities across the state, a little over 700 that that DOT owns, and then another 100 or so that are owned by other departments. Questions there, or we can go to the next slide.
Any questions? No questions here.
Okay, so this slide here is again showing the number of positions across the districts for facilities, maintenance technicians, and then also for equipment and vehicle mechanic positions. And you can see again the vacancy rates there that make it difficult to keep up in the in the wintertime, our focus, so SCF provides vehicles to every state agency, not just DOT and PF. We provide and maintain vehicles for the state troopers, for Fish and Game, for every executive branch agency. We do the maintenance for that. And so on top of keeping all departments' vehicles on the road, during wintertime, our focus is on snow and ice removal equipment and keeping that moving it on the road so that we can keep the roads clear and airports open. And you see here the vacancy rates by district, but kind of to a point that I believe Chair Kaufman was making earlier, when you break these down into individual locations or individual stations, the vacancy rates can get much higher. An example, the Anchorage district there shows 19 positions and a 26% vacancy rate. 10 of those positions are dedicated to heavy equipment repair, which is what winter snow and ice removal requires. And currently we have a 40% vacancy rate in that area with heavy duty mechanics in the Anchorage area. Situations like that create situations where the downtime for equipment when it needs repair and maintenance, it extends that time and makes it more difficult. So kind of to get back to your question or your statement, is there equipment available if you had more operators? With vacancy rates and mechanics tied to that, it is a difficult thing a challenge to keep equipment on the road. Winter snow and ice removal is a maintenance heavy, the equipment takes a beating and requires constant maintenance. And so a challenge we have is, in addition to operators, is keeping mechanic positions filled to keep that winter maintenance equipment on the road. And then on the facility side.
If you would please, Senator Keel has a question.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think if I had the numbers right, you had about 700 non-DOT vehicles, but you talked about all of Fish and Game, state troopers. Number seems low. Is there a dividing line for which vehicles are in state equipment fleet outside of DOT and which are not?
Yeah, sure. Through the chair, Senator Keel. So the slide before showed 8,500 pieces of equipment. About 800 of those are University of Alaska and AHFC and other kind of quasi-state agencies. There's 7,700 pieces of equipment across all departments. About 4,500 of them are DOT assets. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. I must have missed that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Then just touching on the facility side of things, you can see the vacancy right there. Results in about one technician for every 10 facilities to maintain, which would be difficult enough if those 10 facilities were in one location, but like fleet vehicles, like all of DOT's responsibilities statewide and all across the state. So challenges there as well as far as staffing positions and keeping enough technicians and maintenance staff on staff to keep facilities in order.
Senator Keel, we have a question.
Sure. Thank you. So I appreciate the lean operation. I know that in smaller areas, you've got a lot of vehicle mechanics fixing buildings. And I know the truck's diesel and the boiler's diesel, but they're not really the same engine. Can you talk to us about the adequacy of the teams, especially in smaller communities?
Certainly, through the chair, I apologize. I did not catch the senator that was asking the question.
That was Senator Keel.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Keel, you are correct. There is certainly some overlap in the skill set and the tool set and the abilities between maintaining a facility and maintaining a piece of equipment. And certainly we do cross over there sometimes. There are many times, as you mentioned, there'll be a diesel generator in a remote location, and the fleet is sending a mechanic to take care of a loader, let's say at an airport, but they have a backup generator there, and we will service the generator and take care of that. But there are lots of things that do not cross over. Our mechanics, heavy duty mechanics, are not electricians, and vice versa. So there is a requirement, there is a need for both, and the challenge there is both divisions are always supporting each other and supporting highways and aviation and every other division, but having the vacancy rates that we have makes it difficult to have enough folks to go around. Does that answer your question?
Follow up.
Thank you, and I appreciate it, and I have to applaud the department on having a bunch of folks who get it done, but sometimes the heavy equipment mechanics are being electricians. So I guess the question is, if you had the people you're budgeted for, would you have enough folks to maintain your buildings?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'd probably speak more to the equipment fleet side of it. And if we had all of our positions filled, and to reiterate what the commissioner said, pre-COVID, we were looking at between 5 and 10% vacancy rates, and we're at double and triple that now. If we were fully staffed, we would certainly do a much more efficient job of taking care of the equipment and be able to keep equipment and facilities online with less downtime.
All right, thank you. Please proceed.
Okay.
I believe we can go to the next slide, and I can turn it over to Director Hall.
Thanks, Brad. This is, for the record, this is Sean Holland, the Central Region Director. We also have Kirk Warren, who's our Central Region Maintenance and Operations Chief, on the phone that can help answer any questions. I have five slides. I'm going to quantify the November event, and then I'm going to go to speak to how we responded to that event, and then third, I'm going to speak to the lessons learned, I guess, what we're going to do in the future to have a better response to that. I think it's appropriate to share that I'm new to the department, but I did spend 18 years prior. I went to private sector for about 3 years, and then I came back. November 7th was my first official day, and you can see that November 8th was the day that this event started. So it was, and I've always been on the capital side, so it was really eye-opening to me to see how the response to this event was orchestrated. Constant communication from the commissioner down to the maintenance superintendent, and a lot of work went into it, a lot of strategization, and it was impressive for me. I'm sure that you folks saw in the paper this week that Anchorage has 104 inches so far this year. We're above record pace, with still, historically February, March, and April are our snowiest months. So we're gaining on that record, which is 135 inches in the 2011-2012 season. The average is 76, so we're already well above the average. November 23 was the snowiest record, snowiest month on record, snowiest November on record, with over 39 inches in a week. Significantly, if you remember, that snow had a very high moisture content. It added up to 30 inches in that first in a couple days, so significant amount of snow. The water content is significant because, as you know, as especially if it's under traffic, if it gets hit by traffic once, it compacts and compacts hard into ice, which creates this snowpack. So it changes our approach to removing that snow in that, we have high-speed trucks. That's what we're kind of geared around is our high-speed facilities. We get to a point where that snow gets packed on the road and those trucks won't remove the snow. So we have to move to a greater operation, which is much slower operation because, and especially because it's, you have to scrape that snow off. The graders drive slower, and then because you have to scrape that snowpack off, it really slows down the operation. Anecdotally, our crew said that this snow in November took twice as long to clear than a typical snowstorm. Our winter shifts are, they're essentially 24/7. If you look on paper, there's about 3 hours where the stations aren't manned, but certainly if weather is forecast, as in this case, where our crews are available for 24/7 and all personnel are on alert. And really, we're still recovering from this event. You know, another thing that I never really considered, I'm not sure why, but urban snow removal, there's no place to store the snow. So as you're removing this, 39 inches of snow in a week, you have to pick it up and you have to haul it to a snow dump. And I'll talk about it more a little bit later, but in the city of Anchorage, we have one snow dump that we can use, and it's on the corner of O'Malley and Old Seward Highway. So the hard question moving forward is this the new norm? You know, we had last year, I think we were close to a record. This year, I'm betting that we're gonna beat that record. So I don't know. I guess, and personally, I don't think we should gear to a record season. I don't think my opinion is any more important than any of your other constituents. So it's not that significant. But we can always do better, you know. And I think it's our job to kind of provide our crews with fail safes so that we can respond to these unusual or extraordinary events better than we did. And I think I'm ready for the next slide. Oh, sorry. So up on the screen there, there's a list of our equipment in Anchorage. It's, again, important to note, I think, that this is high maintenance equipment. So during this snowstorm, our sidewalk blowers went through more shear pins than they normally go through in an entire season. And if you're not familiar with a shear pin, it's a pin that goes in one of the mechanisms there that creates a weak point so that if the moving parts get overstressed, they don't damage parts that are harder to remove and maintain. They simply shear that pin off. You put a new pin in, and I say that like it's simple. It's not. I mean, it stops the whole operation. It takes time, and it really kills production. The plowing is hard on the trucks and the graders. The snow will get in the engine compartment where it's warm, create moisture. That creates electrical problems. And then, you can't see curb lines, especially with 30 inches of snow. You can't see curb lines. You can't see other obstructions. So it's not uncommon for trucks and graders to hit solid objects. And that's hard on the gear. And then it can break the plows. We crack frames, so they get hit pretty hard. It's also hard on some of the infrastructure. You know, the large snow blowers that we use that pick up the snow, put it into a truck. If the operator's not careful and hits, say, a traffic signal, it can knock that traffic signal off. So there's potential there to do significant damage. And I think my point is there that it's a skilled trade that, I think I was told that it takes about 3 years for someone to be trained to be an effective snowplow driver. High maintenance items, I'll give you a snapshot in time.
Please, if I could, I'd like to fit in.
Oh, sure.
So if you shear a pin, and do you have like a mobile maintenance capability, or can a truck guy with some tools be mobilized out to fix that, or does the piece of equipment have to go back in?
Let's say for a shear pin, they would do that in the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so done in the field. Then another, when you spoke of greater damage, I know one of the anecdotes that the Mayor Bronson tells when the Muni took on some of the state snow plowing was that they ran into, I guess it was a manway the ring, not just the, you know, the cover of it, but it was protruding, I guess, on a route that they weren't used to plowing, and they hit that, and that it really did some damage. You have that on the blade, you have that large ring that rotates. I don't know the exact name for it, but it's a very long piece, and that it broke that, and they had to go back into the shop and replace it. So is there what does that happen to y'all as well? Where you have that, is that just seasonal from frost heaving, or is there anything that can be done to prevent that type of protrusion that really is so hard on the equipment?
To the chair, I feel like it's not as common as it used to be. We've modified our design specs so that the manhole frame and cover has to go below the pavement. So if you drive on any of our highways and you see those, whether it's a sewer manhole or a storm drain manhole, you'll notice that it's recessed now, and that's the reason why. If you want to keep water out of it, you would have it slightly higher than the pavement, but and then you're going to hit it with your plow blade and break probably both your equipment and knock the frame and cover off. But that's the purpose of that, is to keep that below.
Senator Wilson has a question.
That brings a question. How is there a minimum depth or that needs to maintain at? Or do we keep putting asphalt on top of that, and that hole gets deeper and deeper? Point case, Bergaw manhole cover by Costco, as you're heading northbound to the Glen Highway, seems to get deeper and deeper each year. So I didn't know if you guys try to keep that at the same level, or do we just, and I mean, that's the city road, but I just didn't know if there's a standard of how that's maintained.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the standard is 1/4 inch, and we're pretty good at holding that during construction. If we go in and resurface the road, we will adjust that. If we need to, we'll adjust that frame and cover. It's a separate operation. We take the pavement off, readjust that frame and cover to where the grade needs to be, and then go back and pave it so that it's 1/4 inch recessed. Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate my colleague from Metsu pointing out that the assets of Costco are in the community of Anchorage, which has 22 times the population of Metsu. However, I want to ask, you had mentioned about some of these assets, and I know in our community we had stop signs plowed through and unfortunately are now sitting on the sidewalks, not erected, so folks are just blaring through some of the four-way stops. Will these assets be fixed? Will these components be a part of some level of summer restoration, or how does the community let folks know that there might be a stop sign that has been plowed over, or other parts of the community that have been destroyed by plow trucks, snow blowers, other things? Who do they reach out to?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. Certainly, stop signs are important, and so yes, I would say please notify us. There's contact on the on our website. That you could give my office a call if you wanted to, but there's a pothole hotline that you could email or call. And yes, but certainly. Safety hardware such as a stop sign or guardrails or things like that, we would try to repair during the winter. Hopefully that answered your whole question there.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure. Snapshot in time. Yesterday's status for Anchorage equipment, and I included this just to again give you a perspective on how much maintenance it takes to keep this fleet operational. We mentioned we had 48 operator positions, 20% vacant. That means we have about 39 operators position filled in Anchorage. Five of those are seasonal. And again, for perspective, I was going to give you the average full-time employee cost, fully burdened, not money in their paycheck, but what the cost is to the state is between $140,000 and $150,000 a year. And that includes premium time, full-time operator in Anchorage. It varies from region to region based on different regional adjustments to pay. Plow trucks, you can see that we have 13 plow trucks in Anchorage. As of yesterday, we had 6 operational. So we have, our mechanics are working on that, and our operators are also trying to work on that to get that back up to speed, hopefully before we get snow predicted for this weekend. The graders, we have 9 graders total. We have 5 operational. The loaders, all 4 are up, so that's a good number. Highway blowers, we have 2 that are operational. out of the four. Sidewalk blowers are a little bit worse. We have one out of the four operational. In addition to our forces, starting this year, we have on-call contracts for sidewalk blowers. And again, for perspective on the high maintenance, when they assisted us in this during this November snowstorm or event, by the end of it, they were plowing with trucks because all their blowers were broken down. We also have an on-call contract for graders for plowing priorities 3 and 4, and another contract for snow haul. Again, for perspective, snow haul, we're paying $180 an hour for side dumps. The graders are, it varies from between $195 to $250 an hour. That's, we broke it up into three different regions, I believe. So the most expensive one is Eagle River, is travel time for the contractor to get out there. Snow blowers, the sidewalk snow blowers are $175 an hour. So how did we respond to that event? You know, I guess the one thing I wanted to mention just in case, in case any of our crew is listening online, is that I don't feel like I've done a very good job of change management for this. You know, this is the first year for this contract, and we definitely need to maintain the core expert crew that we have there in Anchorage. And I understand that there's some fear there that they'd be replaced 100% by contractors, but that's certainly not the goal. Like I said, we need to maintain that expertise. And the primary use is to level our resources. So if we plan for the average and we have extraordinary years, higher than average years, we can rely on contractors to fill that gap. In our response to the event, several things that we did, we worked with Northern Region, and they provide an additional highway blower so that we could load the snow into the trucks quicker. They also, pertinent to the Mat-Su, they plowed further down on both the Glen and the Parks to allow the Central Region equipment to focus more on the urban areas, Palmer and Wasilla. And I think I can go to the next slide.
Excuse me, sorry, Director Holland. So at the beginning of your presentation, you gave the terrifying scenario of when you came on board and immediately how, you know, all snow hit the fan, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So in the contracting strategy, I've heard that part of the challenge was that the anticipation of when those contracts would be needed was for kind of a typical expectation, but then the need actually predated the execution of the contract or the contract being ready to go. So can you just talk a little bit about what we might be doing around the timing or the flexibility of those contracts to assure readiness?
Yeah, yeah, and you're correct. We were a little bit late on that. I had the dates in front of me, but my computer shut down here. For our on-call contracts, I feel like we didn't have them on board until about the 1st of December. We had the emergency contract as well, which I'll cover a little bit later as a separate contract. They came on about maybe 6 or 7 days after the event started. But yes, so moving forward, our goal is to have those contracts in place no later than October.
Sounds good. We have a couple of questions popping up. Senator Myers, you've been pretty quiet, so we'll just roll to you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm very surprised to see you only have one snow dump.
Yeah.
You know, Fairbanks, we've got 6 or 8, and I think one of the most common spots we stuck the snow dumps is in between the overpasses and the on and off ramps. Anchorage has a lot more overpasses and on and off ramps than Fairbanks does. Is there a reason you're not using those?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I'll kind of cover that a little bit later, but yeah, I mean, I highlighted it because it's significant issue for us is that we need to identify more snow dump areas, and we do have those areas, and maybe that's something that we can look at. It's not on our list, but that's a good suggestion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question from another presentation, and so a little bit of a context, and then hopefully you can help answer. In a Health and Social Services Committee hearing, we heard from the Department of Health that one of the factors that contributed to their significant backlog in SNAP applicant processing was the fact that they couldn't get folks to the office during the major snowfall that we experienced. And I'm looking at the slide and I see there is a supplemental request, but I'm curious if there's going to be additional funds to help some of the unintended consequences of being unable to get snow off the road so we could get state employees into their jobs to help folks who are hungry. And I that's more of a esoteric or just kind of a thing that I'm not sure if they have brought to your attention. I've asked them to talk with this department so that there could be more conversations about the unintended consequences that occur when we are not prepared and ready to be a winter city where we need to remove snow, where we need to get snow quickly off the streets so that folks don't continue to go hungry. So I'm curious with this, if this is just simply the bodies that need to be paid for their overtime, or if there's other things that are contained within the 1.17 million, like the fact that we have such a significant backlog of SNAP applications due to the fact that people couldn't get to work.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. Yes, that 1.17 is it's a cost over our normal operations. It covers our contractor payments, covers our overtime premium, and covers equipment use that we wouldn't have occurred under normal conditions. Certainly significant economic impact from people not being able to, the kids weren't in school for maybe the whole week. People weren't able to get to their jobs. Certainly I wasn't aware of that, but that's also significant.
I believe Senator Keel was up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wilson. Director, I guess the question that I think a lot of Alaskans are asking, certainly my family members up in areas where there have been several big dumps this winter, is I'll back up. Appreciate what you said about maintaining your core team of assets and people that you're going to need all winter long, major storm or not. I think the question that's being asked is that team big enough? Do you have the assets, right? It's been quite some time since the November storm, and I think you told us you have 45% of your plow trucks ready to go. So you don't build a church for Christmas and Easter, but you ought to be able to handle a baptism and a wedding. They come pretty regularly. Can you?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, respectfully, that's a subjective question. In my opinion, we're geared up for an average snow year. If we could fill our 48 positions in Anchorage, that level of service is different for everybody. So again, I'm one constituent in the city of Anchorage. There are plenty of perspectives on that. Does that answer your question or
no?
Well, I guess I feel like we're geared up to handle the average snow year. That if we get that 73 inches in Anchorage, then I think we have adequate resources for that.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that when I look at the chart, right, we've had 4 years where we're over 30 in November. So 73 in a winter seems like maybe it's not the right target.
I guess the question is what's the trend there? And what's the response? Thank you. So Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. Just want to follow up on Senator Meyer's question on snow dumps. And in a situation of emergencies, is there a way to just get a waiver from DEC and just you have an inlet there and in Anchorage? I just don't know the process, and I know a lot of folks have, I don't know if we can get that official answer on the record or just sort of that process. I mean, it just seems that if we can move it fast enough before it gets contaminated from motor vehicle, that there should be a process to do that. I mean, the same thing here in Juneau. I mean, your high-speed grader, technically, down Egan, it just goes right there in the inlet. I mean, it's not like you plow on the side of the road and gently remove it. That's all in the inlet.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson, Ryan Anderson for the record. Yeah, we have got permits in other areas similar to that for these emergency events. I don't think it's something that in Anchorage we have tried yet, but I think we would take that back as a consideration and just kind of run down how that would work. But we appreciate that comment.
I just want to give us a time check. We still have some slides to go, and we want to try and cover it at least to the point where we can have some, if we need to have follow-up on these, but if we can, hold back as much as possible, and let's roll through the remaining slides, and then maybe any questions we have at the end we can hit if we have time left.
And again, Sean Holland, for the record. I'll respect that, and I'll try to speed up my presentation a little bit here. On the last slide, other things that we did to respond to that event were we worked with our partners with the city. We have an excellent relationship at an operational level with the city maintenance group, and we help each other where we can. And again, my opinion, the most efficient way that we can serve the city of Anchorage is to work together as a team. We do have a TORA in place, a transfer of responsibility agreement, which we spoke to earlier, and that includes 5 pages of road swaps. DOT, I spoke to this, plows high-speed facilities more efficiently. The municipality can handle neighborhoods and smaller streets more efficiently. So it's kind of broken down like that. The DOT owns some odd roads all over the state, and Anchorage is not an exception. The other factor in which roads we swap, Inger and Gamble is probably an example of that, is that it's regional. It's not efficient for, say, a city plow to plow a city road, pick up their blade, and move to another city road while they're driving across a state road. So those things are considered. In the case of this event, the mayor and the commissioner capitalized on that relationship. They developed an emergency memorandum of agreement so that the state could reimburse for some assistance on the roads that were not in that TORA. And this helped the city snow removal too, because they haul across some of our priority 2 roads to get to their snow dumps. And if you can't haul efficiently, then it's gonna slow down your operation. In the scope of things, that assistance was not significant from a dollar figure. It would cost us a little bit over $30,000. That was for 135 man hours. 20 different people worked on that over 2 different days. That event was declared an emergency, and I kind of spoke to this already on Senator Tobin's question, that $1.1 million is in a supplemental budget request, covered a cost over. The emergency we had 3 emergency contracts for snow removal. That was 2 graders apiece, and we had 1 contract for emergency snow hauling. So moving forward, again, it being my first week, it was a learning opportunity for me, and I think an event like that shows us where we're deficient, and it gives us an opportunity to improve. So generally, like I said, we're going to try to have those contracts in place in October. And the next bullet, we failed, and we continue to not meet expectations for clearing the sidewalks in the path. And that's not a reflection at all of our crews and their efforts. That's my job, essentially, to give them the resources that they need to be able to adapt to an extraordinary event like this and provide better service. So we're investigating a few things. We want to equip some of our summer seasonal equipment with blower attachments. This will lower the operation or the ownership costs of some of those pieces of equipment. We have loaders and tractors that we use to mow that are parked during the winter. For a perspective, an attachment, snowblower attachment for a loader is about $350,000 to $450,000. That's capital expenditure, and you can amortize it over the life of the piece of equipment. The tractor is a less sturdy, snowblower, and it's worth about $70,000, capital cost. We're dedicating 2 operators to start on sidewalks at the start of the onset of an event. That's if we have 2 snowblowers available, and then we transition more support as the roads are cleared. Our operations again require us to pick up the snow off the sidewalk right away. So we are looking at several different options for new snow dumps, and we're going to approach the city as our partners. They have many more snow dumps than we do, and we can see if we can barter a deal there so that we can open up some more opportunities there. We also failed to meet expectations on the priorities 3s and 4s. This is the first year that we've had those on-call contracts, and we're still trying to establish that trigger. But generally, if we're challenged to meet our performance goals of 12 hours for a priority 1, 18 for a priority 2, 24 and 30 for the priority 3 and 4. After the conclusion of the event, that call is made at an operational level. The superintendent decides whether he needs to add those resources to meet those performance goals. We're going to also investigate installing gates on our graders, which will allow us to go through an intersection and carry at least most of that snow across the intersection rather than casting it to the side, which again created those berms, which created those huge bumps on mostly on our priority 2 roads. And we're also going to revisit the Toro with the city. Our last slide in so specifically to sidewalks, we have just under 150 miles of sidewalks, 1655 vehicle lane miles. Again, to give you that measure. So there's significant pedestrian facilities. Again, we talked about the limited snow storage and the fact that, you know, if we don't orchestrate that properly, then we're putting snow, you know, if we plow the sidewalk too early, we're putting snow into the road, which again gets plowed back onto the sidewalk. So we kind of have to do that at the same time to be able to create a pile that we can pick up and move. So the priority for our sidewalks kind of meets the priority for our roadways, so that we can accomplish that more efficiently. That's something that we may need to take a look at over the next year to see if we can improve the service there. And then I guess the complete streets is the last bullet there, and we are working on a policy on that. We need to modernize some of our roads in Anchorage. That'll provide us some additional snow storage on some of those streets, which again will help. The other thing that it may work against us a little bit is you know, we're always going to err on the side of safety, but there's things like constructing roundabouts or adding lanes or installing those pork chop islands too that provide the pedestrian refuge that increase the effort required to remove the snow.
Just a quick question. So the snow plowing strategy that we see, we move snow, we push it. And if you look in other jurisdictions, they seem to like to lift, load it, and take it away, at least in tight conditions. Is there any thoughts about our snow handling strategy, the difference between just pushing it to the side or actually being able to lift it, get it into the back of a side dump and then get rid of it?
Yeah, to the chair. You can go a lot faster and move that snow into a pile than you can pick it up and put it into a truck. And that's our operation now, is that, you know, we pile it up and then we come back and pick it up, put it in a truck and haul it. But identifying snow dumps in different areas of the city is going to be important for us to be able to make that more efficient. If we have to haul everything back to Old Seward and O'Malley, if you think you're on the far side of town, that's a long haul. It takes a long time. So we're looking at two or three different sites, and we'll follow up on some other suggestions we got here today.
Okay. If the committee agrees, I do want to leave some time just for the avalanche. So if any just quick kind of lightning round questions, and then we'll give a little bit of time to the avalanche control.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly. Thank you. Actually, this one's a comment, and it's on this slide and your comments on the last one, Director. I appreciate the introspection. I can tell you that from the time I was living in Anchorage, the work on sidewalks and places for people to walk, and some people, I guess, have winter bikes, is vastly better than it ever was. And it means people can get to school and people can get to jobs who could not before without taking their lives in their hands. The work you're doing, I understand the frustration, the difficulty, is absolutely worth it, and I appreciate the effort.
Thank you for the comment.
Okay. And what I would say to the committee, if there's anything else about snow removal or snow moving, just send it to my office, and we'll forward the questions on. And so I want to thank you for your presentation on all of that, and welcome to the welcome to the project. So if we can, we'll just try and give a few minutes here to the avalanche mitigation and give it its due.
Okay, Chair Coffin, thank you. Avalanche mitigation has been a big part of our program these days, and we've got some new things we're trying. We wanted to make sure we had a little bit of time to tell the Transportation Committee about that. And so on the phone is Mr. Tim Glassett. He's our Avalanche Program Manager. And if it's okay, I would just let him go through and talk through these two slides. Go ahead, Mr. Glassett.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, my name is Tim Glassett. I'm the Avalanche and Artillery Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Transportation. The seventh duty of the department is to develop and implement an avalanche control plan to protect persons who use public highways. We do that in a couple different ways. I'm going to break it down into short-term and long-term measures. Long-term measures are engineering design that we've done. And if I can draw your attention to the upper left picture here on the slide 14, that's the section of highway between Girdwood and Byrd on the Stewart Highway. At the time, the old road alignment, that's the current bike path, that was considered by preeminent avalanche engineer as the most dangerous highway in North America in regards to avalanche risk. With the department move from that alignment down to the current alignment, it's no longer the case. So the department does a lot of different things, and you know, permanent measures is the long-term solution that I look to implement. The problem is that is capital intensive. There's a couple projects currently that we're looking at to implement long-term measures, and one of them is the Sterling and Seward interchange. If we can implement long-term measures there, that's going to have a great effect in reducing the risk to the traveling public. And the short-term measures won't be needed. Short-term measures typically are avalanche mitigation through explosive use or preventative closures. If I can draw your attention to the matrices on the bottom right of the slide, the top matrix shows typical avalanche hazard index values and mitigation measures.
Hold on 1 second. Yeah, go ahead, Chair.
I just wanted to pause for a minute and ask the committee if we were collectively all right with going another 5 minutes just to give this some time. Yeah, okay. All right, and everyone good? So let's continue. Thank you.
For the record, Tim Glassett, Avalanche Program Manager and Artillery Program Manager for DOT. Looking at these matrices again, the typical mitigation measures for different hazard risk highways is identified in that top matrix. This lower matrix identifies those state highways and the mitigation measures that are employed. And you can see the top three highways in that matrix are the ones where we currently have artillery, which is our primary means to mitigate avalanches. There's a couple issues with artillery. In essence, the Army has told us that we need to move away from artillery. So I am planning for the next 5 to 15 years that artillery will no longer be an option. What the department is doing now is looking at long-term solutions. One of those is RACS, or Remote Avalanche Control Systems. Before I move on to slide 15, are there any questions with slide 14?
I think we're good. Sorry about the artillery, though.
For the record, Tim Glassett, Avalanche Program Manager. There are a couple issues with artillery, and we can get into those at a later date. But what the DOT is doing right now, we've got two initiatives that are both in the research phase. One of them is using remote drone UAS docks that are programmed to, on an interval, map avalanche paths. And how that is useful is if we have continuous data flowing in, we can determine where snow is being distributed, and we can better affect where our mitigation with explosives is done. Additionally, that will help us plan for the eventual build-out for remote avalanche control systems. The other innovation that we're working on. And again, you know, these two are in research phase, is deploying explosives by UAS. We have worked on two different systems, tested them both. One of them, we found that it was not safe enough to deploy explosives with it, and we told the manufacturer that there were some items that needed to be addressed before we were comfortable doing that. The second system that we tested this last month, we went through multiple procedures with it to determine if it was safe to drop explosives in a controlled use area, and we ended up doing that. The usefulness for UAS mitigation will come into play, you know, truly when artillery is gone. There's no one system that can replace artillery, and UAS mitigation will fill the gap for places where we can't afford to put in remote avalanche control systems.
Okay. Continue, please.
I believe that concludes the slides on the avalanche.
Then we have a question.
Quickly, I guess, and you don't have to answer now. Just wondering, is it just we're using the Army's equipment and we just can't acquire our own equipment, or they're just not providing shells? Is there opportunity for us to continue if there's no alternative better than artillery? Why change something that seems to be tried and true? And if there's possible to see these demonstrations, both of artillery and drone, I know myself and a couple other committee folks in this body and the other body would love to watch this demonstration occur to see the utilization of some of this drone technology in place.
Again, for the record, Tim Glassett, Avalanche Program Manager. Thank you for the question. I appreciate it, Senator. Through the chair, sorry about that. To address some of that, artillery is going away for multiple reasons. We have an MOA with the U.S. Army, and as soon as there are commercially viable products available, we will move away from this artillery piece. And the state of Alaska has gone through four different types of artillery. This is the fourth. I'm happy to talk more about it at a later date. The ability to go observe these things for UAS mitigation, you know, in this the testing phase, we really need to limit who is there for their safety and our own safety. As these technologies get developed, I think there are opportunities for that. The UAS mitigation, just to give you an example, our FAA-approved testing area is on the Alaska Railroad, so it's a we're developing this in partnership with the Alaska Railroad within multiple departments of DOT, and we're working very close with explosive manufacturers that supply explosives to avalanche programs and drone manufacturers. What we found with this last month's testing is that we went back to the drone manufacturer that's developing this system and told them that there still needs to be more work before it's operational. So we're looking to potentially test a redeveloped system in the future that meets our safety standards.
Just a quick question.
Quick.
When's our timeline that we have in terms of ending the artillery program?
Again, through the chair, Tim Glassett, Avalanche Program Manager, thank you for the question. The timeline is very gray. And that's good and bad. The reliability of artillery, unfortunately, if I was to rank it from A to F, it's an E. And the reason is the U.S. Army can pull all artillery at any time. And so tomorrow, if something happened, we would no longer have this tool at our beck and call. And just for historical reference, that has happened before with the 106 recoilless artillery piece.
Okay. All right. And anything else? If I think I may shift now, we'll just do the quickest wrap-up we can, just a few minutes. There's more slides. I'm sorry we weren't able to get there today, but In closeout, let's just wrap up what we did today, and then I'll say to the committee, if you have any questions on the following slides, again, please forward those to my office. We'll pass them along and share the answers. So in closing.
Yeah, to the chair, Commissioner Ryan Anderson, for the record. Yeah, I think what you see today, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, 15 slides was all we were able to get through talking about winter storm events. There's always a lot more to talk about, and we're always happy to do that if the committee would wish to, and on any topics there. You'll see the breadth of things and how interconnected they are when it comes to our equipment operators and then our mechanics, our facilities, and how all these things work together at DOT. And we do share resources as much as we need to provide that service to the public. And that's something, you know, this idea of having that strong team that, you know, we're all working towards those common goals of, you know, that getting those roads plowed, keeping our highways safe. You know, that's the direction we're going amongst all these challenges. But appreciate the time today. I think hopefully that gave you a good sense of where we're at DOT and our attitude, you know, for moving this forward. So thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and to all of those who attended and testified today. I want to give a shout out to those testifying on the phone. That's not easy. And so I really want to just acknowledge their efforts, especially, for hanging in with us. So I also, as always, want to thank the Committee Records LIO support staff who helped today's meeting run as smoothly as it did. Our next meeting is to be announced. We have not set that meeting date yet. It's pending, but that information will be forthcoming. Do we have any closing comments from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I have been about 50 feet away when they shot off the artillery up Natigan Pass once. Really interrupted my nap.
All right. So noted. If you're going to wake up, it'd be for something like that. So. All right, so this meeting is now adjourned at 3:10 p.m.